the beautiful things of childhood, laughter, joy, dreaming big dreams. I rarely had any of that. And I think the most horrible thing of all was when you went to bed at night, you had that gnawing sense of wanting to fuck up a friendship. We've been friends all our life. And at early on, he and I used to chum together and play soccer and, you know, play cricket and all those games that we love. And he was just like my family. They expected their kids, when they got a little older, 5, 6, 7, to begin to pitch in and help Ma and Pa. Well, what can a child do? Beg or steal? That's all you really can do. And so early on, my little sister and I would go out and beg. And when Lucas and I became good chums, he would go with me. And in the early days, you beg. I mean, a little bit smarter, or is it a little braver, or is it dumber, I'm not sure. Then you start to steal. And when Lucas and I became kind of a team, it was real good he was there, because I'd do the stealing, and he'd be the lookout. That way I couldn't get caught. And, you know, that's pretty important if you're going to stay alive, as a couple thieves. And even if I say so, Lucas and I were good at it. We got so we really could take a good heist in some nights, you know. And as far as stealing goes, we didn't really feel too guilty about it. After all, we knew that all the rich people were just as crooked as we were. But they just covered it up by bribes, money given to the right party at the right time, and then loopholes of the law that they could scoot around so they didn't pay taxes or didn't pay revenues. So we really felt that stealing wasn't so bad, because when we got, you know, our share, it's like it's payment for being stuck in a slum on the outside of Jerusalem. We finally were getting what we had coming. Everybody else had the goodies of life, and now it was our turn. Well, anyhow, life went on like that. I very well remember the age of 16, because that's when I left home. One day, Lucas came by to see me, and oh, was he steamed. He was so angry at his father. He said, "I don't think I want to see that man ever again as long as I live. I don't ever want to set foot in my house. Dismiss, let's take off tonight. You know, let's hit the road and be on our own, leave home." Well, you know, I wasn't quite ready to do that. I said, "You know, I'm thinking of going, Lucas, but wow, I don't think tonight. Let's stay a couple days at my house, and maybe then I'll be ready." And that's what we did. So I left home, and you may think, and you may wonder, did our parents love us? Well, yeah, they did. Like a normal dad and mom loved their boys and their girls. But when we left, they were awfully relieved. One less mouth to feed, less laundry to do, less bedding and all that sort of stuff to take care of. And, you know, all of that rigmarole was gone. So they were sad to see us go, but they said, "Oh, praise the Lord, they're gone." You know, kind of a little bit of both. One thing that I found as a thief is that we had a lot of anger. You know, I don't think anybody knows really where anger and rage come from. I mean, it's not an easy thing to say, "I know why I'm angry." But, oh man, I had a trigger anger. If someone set me wrong, boy, zingo, I could just go off and, you know, fly like a kite. But I was nothing compared to Lucas. Wow, he's like a time bomb. You got him mad or got him upset, he'd soon as kill a man as look at him. So Lucas and me, people just sort of left us alone, because they knew if they got too close to us, we'd probably blow up, and they'd probably pay for it big time. Did I learn any religion? Probably not much. It seemed like when we thought about going to synagogue, we never had the right clothes. I didn't have a good suit, couldn't afford one. Lots of times I didn't have shoes. You know, in Israel, you don't have to have shoes. You can get by. Sometimes they didn't even have sandals. Well, you can't go to synagogue barefoot, for pity's sake. And my mother never thought she had nice enough clothes, and Dad, I don't know, he just didn't seem to care to go. As a result, synagogue was not an important part of our life. I remember Mom folding my fingers and telling me how to pray to Yahweh God. So I knew there was a God, and she tried to tell me about God. And I heard about, you know, Adam and Eve and the stories, and I heard about Abraham. I heard about Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 sons, you know, the tribes. I knew all of that, a little bit. So I wasn't totally, you know, irreligious, but Lucas, he was something else. I don't think he had a religious bone in his body. You know, all God was is a curse word. God this, and God that. And he was really very offensive. And, you know, deep down in my psyche, I had a dream. Someday, I was going to give up this world of thievery and go home to Mama and finally make her proud of me. You know, I know Mom and Dad expected us to help out. And so we started to beg and steal. But deep down, I knew that she wasn't proud of me for being a common thief. And so I'd go home, and for the first time in my life, I'd make Mama proud of me. But I never told Lucas. In fact, if Lucas knew I was thinking about that, I don't know what he'd have done. It might have even been dangerous for me. I'm not sure. At least, that was a kind of a private agenda. And I never told Lucas at all. One thing, as Lucas and I went about our life at thievery, we never messed with Rome. You know, Rome, that's dangerous stuff. They've always got too many legionnaires around, and everything's protected and double guarded. So we just left them alone entirely. But we'd rip off shopkeepers, go into certain stores, or financial institutions. Those are the ones we'd rip off. But Romans, we always left them alone and would never, ever bother them at all. Well, one day, Lucas is over in a bar on Palm Street Avenue, and he heard a couple of Roman legionnaires talking about a gold shipment. And apparently they were going to bring the gold shipment to the palace of Pontius Pilate, you know, it's called Antonia, and they were going to park it in a shed next to the horse stable. Well, his thought was, that sounds like it won't be guarded very closely. So probably that would be fairly safe. Well, he told me about it. He was real excited. I said, I don't know. Well, he said, let's try it. There's probably just a few guards, and we'll probably be able to make a good heist of a gold shipment, and we'll go on big time. So we went. Yes, we found Pilate's palace. Yes, we found the horse stable and the storage shed. Yes, we found the gold shipment. Yes, we took care of the two guards. That's all there were, guarding it. But when we got in and started to steal these goods, little did we know about the five guards who were out of sight. And bingo, they came in, and yeah, you know what happened next. We were thrown in a dungeon. And in Rome jargon, there's a two-step process if you ever wrong Rome. Number one, you're thrown in jail, dungeon. Number two, you're crucified at the next convenient time. So Lucas and I were dead men. We were gone. I asked my guard when it would be, and he said next Friday, and that was Wednesday. Well, I lounged around my cell for a while, and finally, late in the day, Friday, I think it was around afternoon, after noon lunch, they came for us and took me out and took Lucas out. We went down to the cross yard. The cross yard was just a great collection of crosses. Because, you know, Rome would sometimes crucify 3, 4, 5 people a week, sometimes more. Then they stick him on this great big boulevard, and they leave the bodies there for weeks at a time. That was a not so subtle reminder to anybody who had ideas of rebelling what happens when you do. And I tell you, it was quite a dissuasive thing. People did not bother Rome very much when they could see what would happen if they did. Well, we went down to get our crosses and pick them up. But we were surprised because there was the third guy there. We didn't know about him. I asked my guard, who is he? He said his name is Jesus. I said, really? Why is he here? He said, well, apparently the Jewish authorities have got a rhubarb with him, and they decided to kill him on a cross, and Pilate gave the okay, although Pilate wasn't convinced he was guilty. I said, you mean Lucas and I are guilty of sin, we're going to the cross, and this Jesus who is innocent is going to the cross? That doesn't make any sense. By the way, that Jesus was in terrible shape. Someone had stuck a crown of thorns, you know, great big long thorns on his head and jammed it in his skull. The blood was pouring down his face. The flies were just covering his face, and his back must have been whipped, I don't know how many times. The robe was ripped to smithereens, and there were great big pieces of flesh hanging off. That man looked absolutely wretched. My thought was he'll never have strength to carry a cross. Well, anyhow, Lucas and I picked up our cross and headed toward Golgotha. We got there, threw down our cross with relief, and then the bad times started. Some guard grabbed me and threw me down like a piece of flotsam and stuck out my hands and jammed in great big steel spikes and hammered them down. Then crossed my legs and hammered a spike through them. Do you know what pain is? I can't describe the pain. I fainted, dead away. A lot of that first part I can't even remember. And then if that wasn't enough, they took this big cross and raised it up and jammed it down in the socket. And then I had five times as much pain all over my entire body. The agony was so great, I can't describe it. Well, then we were up there, Lucas and me, on our cross, stuck up in the air, and here comes Jesus walking. And some black guy was carrying his cross. And then it hit me. Sure, he didn't have strength, so they drafted somebody else to carry it. Well, the black guy threw down the cross, and they did the same number on Jesus they did on me. They hammered him down, set him up, and there we were, the three of us. I don't know what was possessing the crowd. Stupid. They were so vehemently opposed to Jesus. Women that seemed to be normal otherwise were just absolutely like they had a thing about this Jesus. You know, they'd persecute him, they'd harangue him, they'd make fun of him. Who are you, Jesus? Do you think you're some kind of emissary from God? Why don't you come down from that cross? Then we'll believe in you if you are the Christ. Why don't you see if you can get off? Then we'll decide you're really somebody. It just went on and on and on. I don't know what their case was those people had against this man. He must have either done something terrible, or I had no idea. But it just went on and on. And then the whole scene of insanity kind of spilled over onto me and Lucas. And Lucas began to yell at him, hey, Jesus, if you're such a big, fancy, spiritual dude, why don't you get me and Dismas off these crosses? Then we'll believe in you. Oh, that made me mad. I yelled over at Lucas. I said, shut your mouth. Don't you have a spiritual bone in your body? Can't you see that you and I are here because we're guilty? And the man in the middle cross, Jesus, hasn't done a thing. He's innocent. I'll leave him alone. Well, then, I don't remember exactly when, but Jesus spoke up and said, Father, forgive them, for they don't even know what they're doing. All of a sudden, it was like a ding-ding light in my head. This man in the middle cross is like Elijah, or he's like Ezekiel or Isaiah. He's a great man of God. He's not an ordinary bloke. And I can't tell you what happened. The pain didn't go away. And I didn't lose a sense of what this horrible, monstrous occasion, but I saw Jesus as maybe a little ray of hope. And I turned to Jesus, and I still don't know why I did it, but I said, Jesus, when this whole nightmare is over, and you go into your kingdom, will you take time to remember me, Dismas? I don't know why I said it, but I did. And then Jesus, for the first time, turned and looked at me, and he said, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. No, you're right, I wasn't sure what it meant either. Yeah, I puzzled a long time. Paradise. Probably what it meant is that when I went across, I wouldn't go alone. Probably what it meant is that it would happen today. When this agony was over, there'd be a ray of light and hope at the end of the road. Paradise. Maybe what it meant is that the first time in my life, Dismas the loser would become Dismas the saved one. And I could be scrubbed clean of the pain of life and the hurts and, you know, the sin and the crud. For the first time in my life, that would all be gone. And I'd be in paradise. Maybe what it meant is that for the first time in my life, I had a chance to tell my story to you. And I can remind you that paradise is something all of us might think about, or might look at, or might hope for when we get to the other side. Thank you for letting me tell my story on this special occasion. I'm always glad that that's over. Tomorrow, my friend Lola and I are going to do the dialogue Cleopas and Mary on the Emmaus Walk. And we're going to talk about just what that Emmaus Walk was like. That's Luke 24. And we'll be doing that tomorrow here at the chapel. I didn't warn you early. I'm going to ask you to read Luke 23, just that one. And that lays us a story about business. Excuse me.
And when they were come to the place, which is called Calvary, there they crucified him, along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, He saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, the chosen one. The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine and vinegar and said, If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. There was written a notice above him which read, This is the King of the Jews. One of the criminals hurled insults at him. Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other criminal rebuked him. Don't you fear God? He said, Since you are under the same sentence, we are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said, Remember, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus answered him, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise.
Thank you. That's it. Well, thank you a little attempt at the scriptural basis that I'm trying to use as I'm trying to compose a story. And as you can hear, I took some license, but I think hopefully it was fairly accurate. I'm going to use a joke this morning, and it's going to be an ethnic joke, but I want to tell you that I'm Norwegian. And so I think if you make a joke about yourself, then it probably can't offend, right? So anyhow, I think it's kind of a cute joke about Lena and Ole were up in bed one night. And Lena was always worried about robbers coming in her house, you know, and breaking in. And she pokes Ole and says, "Ole, yeah, Lena, get up and go downstairs. There's a robber." "Oh, you and your robbers. There's no robber down there." "Yes, there is. Get up and go down and look." So Ole says, "Okay, I'll go down and see what I can find." So he turns on the light and goes downstairs. And sure enough, there's a robber. He said, "This is a holdup. Get your hands up." Ole says, "Now look, if you don't hurt me, you can have anything that you want. But would you do me a favor?" "Do you a favor? Would you come up and meet Lena? She's been expecting you for 20 years.
I think that's kind of corny. But kind of cute.
Well, let's get right to the Bible study sheets this morning. And we'll look them over. And one more back there for the three. There we go.
There you go.
Oh, that's doesn't work.
That's okay.
No, they're the two attempts. Is I'm going to give a little explanation of the cross. Is my attempt.
Sure. I'll share with Don.
So you got to have one too.
Oh, I do. Okay. Keep it happy.
I see you knitting there. I just want to be sure you can read what's going on. Yep.
One
more. Okay.
Thank you.
Everybody got one now? Okay, let's start with, let me see, number two. This must have a set, pardon me?
Oh, someone
that's neat.
She's
neat. Oh. Yes. No, you're supposed to say gazetmate.
Oh, gesundheit!
Okay.
You're supposed to say, Dankeschön.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
One thing before you start, I don't think women could go to synagogue. Okay. To be able to...
Oh, that's right. That makes it incorrect. Thank you, Roy. That's one thing I really am concerned about, that they're always accurate. And they don't have a piece of information that doesn't fit.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, they go to the courtyard where the other women are, and they still would want to look nice.
Yeah. But you said they were going to synagogue.
Yeah, and that's incorrect. Thank you, Roy.
Maybe you could say to the synagogue, rather than in the synagogue.
Into the synagogue.
Right.
Just change the preposition, right?
To
yeah, I appreciate it. Any comments like that, I please appreciate them, because if and when I do a revision at all, I'll try to make them correct. Okay, number two. This must have a sudden onrush of insight. How come? A, finally it dawned on Didymus who Jesus really was. B, because Israel is a small nation, Didymus had already heard about Jesus. I missed that in my monologue, but I had in my script that Didymus had heard of him. That in, you know, 3 years of Jesus wandering around, Didymus had heard of him in his, you know, thievery, that he was at least there, but I forgot to put it in. C, the Holy Spirit filled Didymus, and in a heaven-sent moment, he just knew. D, Didymus always was lucky, and once more his luck held out. E, Didymus saw a long-shot chance to maybe save his skin. F, Didymus was only saying some nice words. He believed none of it. Other explanations.
I'll vote for A.
A? No. Finally, it dawned in Didymus who he really was. Right?
I would vote for C.
C? The Holy Spirit filled Didymus, and in a heaven-sent moment, he just knew.
Okay. But what I see happening is that all of his life he's been struggling with material things, trying to eat, you know, and especially when you're on your own, he's no longer in his father's house. So he had to somehow find lodging and take on all that responsibility of the physical self. And he, all of his life he was filled with, that was his purpose in life. was to surround himself with material things.
So to survive.
Yeah, to survive, right. And even to look good, to go beyond that survival level. And this is all very cognitive. And he never had, you pointed out, he had very little spiritual background. He never really was plugged in to a spiritual life at all. Mm-hmm. And the spiritual life and the cognitive life are two different arenas entirely.
Very often they are.
Yeah, they are. And love and compassion and all of sure. that is all very much spiritual. And right brain, which is so opposite of the left brain, which he'd been struggling so hard with to get what he needed. Then suddenly he had an aha. The Holy Spirit came in. I mean, when you're up on the cross, man, it makes no difference how much money you've got.
No, that's yeah. really not too
important. Yeah, right. We all get to that place in life where somewhere along the line, nothing means anything except your spiritual self.
Yeah. You know, going back to that point of survival, when you leave home and you and everything now is on your own.
Yeah.
I think of two things. One is in Arizona City. Yeah, I'm a musician, and I play organ and piano on Sunday mornings at a church. And one day I came out of the post office, and across the parking lot was a young man. I guess he's 40, I found out later, but it didn't matter. To me, he's young.
Yeah, right.
And he's playing guitar. And my thought was, well, why would you play guitar outside your house in the presence of a parking lot unless you're probably pretty lonely or unless you really love to play guitar? In either one, would be fine. But I walked up because I'm a musician. I kind of enjoy people who enjoy music. Well, the point I'm going to get to is when we got to know each other, his name was Lex, and he's a delightful young guy, but he's had a hard life. At 11 years old, his father had discovered that all his weapons, and he was a real weapon collector, had all been stolen. And it was totally unknown to his father, surprise. Stolen 3 months earlier, I guess. But he blamed Les, this little 11-year-old boy. And he came into his bedroom in the middle of the night, like 3 a.m, and was beating him mercilessly for stealing guns that he hadn't stolen. And Les kept saying, Dad, I didn't take him. I don't know anything about your blankety-blank guns. Leave me alone. But he wouldn't. He just kept beating him. As I heard the story, and I think I've got fairly close. Well, what Les did, at 11, he left home. And you see, I put myself in that boat and think of it, me as an 11-year-old boy on a South Dakota farm. What would I do to survive and stay alive? Well, I think it's fairly close to distance, and how he left home, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I painted him as a beggar, and that could be way off, I don't know. But what would it be like to survive on your own at a young age with nobody to support you? And if you didn't make it, there's no place to go. You can't go home to mama, you can't go to grandpa. Mm-hmm. You are, well, anyway. And just really, yes. I just all of a sudden yeah. I thought I really had a pampered life when I
yeah.
look back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Yeah. Anybody else got a comment?
Why this was have that insight?
I sort of agree. I think it was probably A. And I like the point that you brought in about the mother giving some base, because when you read stories of inner city kids who are survivors, who make it, or who make a turnaround, they almost always credit their mothers for giving them some basis when they were very young. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes something clicks in their life and they can retrieve that, you know, religious basis.
Start over
or build on that. And so that was, I thought that was very appropriate that you brought that in. I don't know why that is, why it always has to be the mother who the child remembers.
Is that a little bit of light?
That.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
that little hope.
Yeah.
So that, I think something probably clicked, and he was thinking, my mother.
Maybe he did have a moment where he'd like to make mama proud of him.
Yeah.
Well, I had that in my last closing deal.
Yeah.
When I get across, if I meet mama, she'd finally be proud of me.
Yeah.
That's paradise.
Yeah.
I had also C and A, and then on my second choice would be B. B
Because Dismas probably knew about Jesus a lot more than they indicated in my script. He probably could have known quite a bit. He wasn't a follower or anything like that, but he probably was acquainted. Israel's not that big that it couldn't have, you know, been something he would have known. Any other comments before we move on? I've got a second question that's not in the sheet. What was Dismas like? If you met him, we're just assuming, of course, we have no idea, but what kind of person do you think he would have been? Let's just flesh him out a little way and make some assumptions.
Furtive.
Which?
Furtive.
What?
Furtive.
F-U-R-T-I-V.
What does that mean?
Well, he's alert and wary.
Wary?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's always
on the lookout.
On the lookout.
Yeah.
Always.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
On guard.
Okay. Very good. I think you're right.
Streetwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, streetwise. Yeah. That's pretty close.
Yeah. Streetwise.
Okay. Another one. I had angry. I think he'd be a very angry guy. Mm-hmm. And I painted him as a time bomb. That could be off, but probably not too far off. Because when you feel like you're persecuted by life, and by the way, you get located in a slum, you get very angry, and you have a bad rap, and you see the whole world is against you. Kind of paranoid problem. Okay.
There's really nothing that says, gives any age indication, though, is there?
No.
I mean, he could have been sort of an older...
Oh, sure.
Who had survived longer on the streets than...
He could have been in his 50s.
Yeah.
He sure could have.
It's a little hard to say.
I have a hunch he probably was younger, because the Romans, of course, that's unfair to say he got caught by the Romans. Well, he did get caught by the Romans, or he wouldn't be on a cross.
Yeah, right.
So, quite often, if you're in the thieving business, that's a high-risk business.
Yeah.
You probably don't live too many years before you finally get caught. But you're right, it could have been. I think he was uncouth. I think he would have been kind of gross. Not that that made him bad, but I just think he didn't have the finenesses of life because he never was acquainted with it. No one taught him. And I think he was big and strong. I think he had big muscles. Yeah. Probably was a big, brawny man. Just a guess. Yes, we don't know, do we? Very little, that's obvious. Anybody else? Any guess?
I think of him as a small man, darting, quick.
And just as bad.
Agile.
Yeah. Kind of sneaky.
Yep.
Doubtful dodger. Very good, Lola.
Well, it doesn't say anything about that, so anybody can relate themselves. I can relate myself to him.
And how would you relate it then?
Well, I mean, you know, I can look at it and say, what am I stealing? You know, I mean, you don't have to be an outright thief to steal something.
I'm sure that's very true.
You know, so I can say.
Let's take number five in the light of that, Don, and look at that. I've got a contemporary question here. Are the citizens in today's America losing the quality of honesty? Like Don mentioned, you don't have to steal to be a thief. Is it true that every person, including Dismas, has their price? What are the reasons why America is fast becoming a nation of thieves? How do you want to comment on that one? What do you think? Am I too negative, too skeptical, or am I on target?
No, it's right on target. I think that the citizens in today's America is very much like Dismas in the fact that we're all reaching out for physical things, and we're not on the same level he is. I mean, we're not street people, but we're on a higher level, but as far as income and so forth, but still we're reaching out for more and more and more and more. And we have so many employees that steal from their employers. I mean, like pencils and paper. I mean, it's not hitting it hard, but it's just they owe it to me because I give so much to the company and they owe it to me.
Who knows why, but they do it.
Yeah, they do. Oh, there's, it's rapid.
My daughter was a security, that meant kind of a cop, at a Target store. Uh-huh. That was her job. She did that job for 5 years. And you know who was the worst offender?
The little maids.
No. The employees.
Employees, sure.
Yeah.
The employees stole from their own company.
Yeah.
They're the ones Debbie had to watch the most. I just think, oh my word. Here I'm a manager and I'm hiring you to be on my staff.
Yeah.
And later on you're going to stick it to me by stealing me blind.
Yeah, right.
What a horrible world we've developed.
Yeah.
Just imagine.
Some companies write off 5 to 10% that they allow.
For a theft?
For theft.
Do they really?
Yes.
What kind of world have we got?
I really question that. I don't think it's a whole lot different than any other world that's ever been.
I mean, it's been that way forever.
Yes, sure.
I'm naive and I don't see the reality of
it. I think we like to think it used to be better.
Oh, for the good old days?
I remember we used to go on the steamer up in Norway. You could leave your stuff. Nobody would touch a thing. Go into the school, and if you had a pencil there, it would be there when you got back. Now, it's not that way today.
In Norway?
But it was 30 years ago. Yeah, 20 years ago.
So even in good old Norway, things aren't quite the same.
Well, that's because of the tourists, probably.
Who's the tourist? The ugly American?
I think we're going to pay for that one.
I need to share with you an incident that happened in Bellingham right before we came to Holden.
Yeah.
We have a, there's a Myers store. It's one of these big department stores. And they had a gas station that went with it. And it was run, the manager was a young man, and they had two other employees that were young. I'm saying young, they were in their 20s.
That's real young.
Yeah, that's quite young. Anyway, the story is that they were taking money out of the till. You know, it's a drive up, pump and then you drive up.
Sure.
They were taking money out of the till, they were buying drugs with it, and they were dispersing drugs from that little station.
Oh,
they would get telephone calls from people in jail, and someone would come and pick up the drugs and drop it. I don't know how they got it in the jail, but they did. But they had this lucrative business going on, and the police got whiffed of it. And of course, they chased the place for a while, and they closed in. All three guys were arrested, and the general manager of there's like. I don't know, 15 different stores in our area of Myers. And so the manager, who was in California, was just, of course he fired them all and they're all up for trial. But I mean, here they are using their employer's money to buy drugs, to make money for themselves. The whole thing is kind of what? And Bellingham is supposed to be a sleepy little town.
That's entrepreneurship.
Yeah, that's right. It is. Very clever. Very clever.
Only if you put that to a good use.
Yeah, too bad we lost them.
I picked up a hitchhiker on my way to Seattle. And man, was that guy street smart. Oh, my word. And he had a little, what would I call it, integrity. He wouldn't steal. At least he told me that. And he had no need to lie to me. He hadn't told a stranger. He doesn't steal, or his other fellow homeless steal, but he wouldn't do that. He'd even go hungry before he'd steal. Mm-hmm. And he was a professional man. He had been a surgical nurse in a hospital in Iowa. I don't remember the state. And I kept bugging him about getting his butt back in his job. And I said, you're obviously a caring human being, and you need to get back, to get to work. And so, wait, where's my key?
In a place like Poland here, where we expect everyone to be on their absolute best behavior.
Yeah.
Last night at the staff meeting, I talked about people going down and opening up the cartons in the store area.
Yeah.
And stealing nuts, for instance.
Helping themselves.
And then putting it behind everything else so no one would notice
it. Yeah, right.
Because by that time, the vermin were in it. And so they have to throw out, these very expensive items.
Yeah.
No
kidding.
Well, so much of the time people don't think of things like that as stealing. You're simply helping yourself.
Yeah, it's just the community and what belongs to them belongs to me, too.
The more distance emotionally you have from your employer, the easier it is probably to do that.
Sure,
but anytime you have an economic situation where things are tough, you're going to have thievery. Think of Dickens' London.
Mm-hmm.
If you think things were wonderful in the old days,
just
a little literature.
Just look around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I think it's total naivety in my part when I have this rosy picture that is really that close to reality. But maybe back in Kenya, there wasn't much theft. Yeah. I don't think that's so far off, is it? Two generations ago? Wasn't theft pretty rare?
Well, there were other kinds of sin, but there wasn't much theft.
And back in Forest, South Dakota, where I grew up, I don't ever remember hearing about theft. Now, that could be because I didn't want to hear it, I didn't want to see it. But I do think it was fairly rare.
Well, it depends on the interconnectedness of your community. In a Kenyan village, everybody knows each other. You know what people are like. You don't really have an opportunity to steal because they'd be on to you.
Yeah, they'd be on you.
And we live in a very small community, and everybody knows each other. And we don't lock our doors. We leave things out. We don't worry about anything because we know everybody. If somebody steals, I mean, that would be ridiculous. We would know who did it.
If you had someone in a community who was a little, quote, light-fingered, I think is what it used to be called.
Yeah.
They were known.
You'd know it, sure. And if something was missing, you'd just go down and you'd say, hey, Joe, you know, my lawnmower's missing. Did you borrow it?
And then, of course, we all heard the stories about we had no keys to the door and you couldn't find them when you had to finally lock them.
Right.
We heard that.
I think this is really directly related to our loss of our work ethic. Because when we had work ethic, I mean, most of us remember depression. I mean, talk about being poor. Our parents never went out and stole anything. You know, they had their little gardens and they struggled through and they pinched pennies, but it was a work ethic. They kept working at whatever they could work at. They would start selling from door to door. They'd do anything, but they would never steal. But now the work ethic has broken down with a lot of other things in society. And so this, you know, you don't say, well, I'm just going to go out and get a second or third job in, I'm going to scrub floors or I'm going to clean toilets. People don't do that anymore.
But Mary and your guys in Bellingham had a terrific work ethic.
Yes, I know they were working.
And they
there are some exceptions.
Some exceptions. Yeah.
Well, we could go on and on.
Yeah,
this, but
I know it goes on.
No, it's good. It takes some time. I think it's okay. Let's go to question four. You know, Jesus' death impacted business. Now, how has Jesus' death impacted your life and all of your values? A, a little bit. B, a whole lot. C, not as much as it should. D, a lot more now than it used to be. E, I guess I'm not sure. Or other. That's kind of a biggie. And I think in light of Dismas and what happened to him because of Jesus' death right beside him, it becomes pertinent. You know, how has Jesus' death impacted your life or mine? What do you think?
This isn't intellectual. This is personal.
Yeah, very much to your soul.
Yes, this is very right brain.
Good. I got a right brain question. Good for you, Bert.
It's the feeling side of things.
Anybody, do you have a reaction?
Oh, yeah.
Could be different than I have down, you know. Whatever you come up with. What do you think?
Well, I know what my life was before I found Christ. I was raised in a non-Christian home. Mm-hmm. And I was never baptized. It was only when I got to Valparaiso and had to take a religion class as a freshman. This was a requirement, a Lutheran school.
Sure.
I tried to petition out of it, and you had to go through so much red tape. I said, to heck with it, I'll just take this stupid thing. I mean, I had no interest at all in religion. And at the end of that class, I was baptized by the instructor. Tremendous impact.
Is that one?
Yeah.
That is wonderful.
That was my first step into faithing.
That's wonderful.
Then, of course, I had 2 years of, you know, a Christian community at the campus, and I met my husband, who has been a Lutheran all of his life, mm-hmm. and got into the church. I actually joined the church a week after we were married. And I was, you know, I went through catechism and all of that in Chicago.
Did you do it all of
Yeah, I went through the whole nine mm-hmm. yards. And I know how my life is now, and I know the way it was before I had Christ. So I can't even find an adjective to tell you the difference. I just can't even find, you know, the right brain has no language, and I can't find words to to express to you what Christ is, what Christ is in my life.
I think it sounds like it's totally awesome.
Yeah, he's everything.
Pretty close.
He's my total being.
Yeah.
I'm not always the perfect, you know, I'm not perfect.
Well, I don't see any halo in you, but I presume you're human.
I think if I asked Chuck, he would tell me.
No, but my life is just, you know, and I think when you talk to a person who's been converted, they are very much more aware of what this is.
Oh, yeah, it's before and after.
Yeah, the before and after, yeah.
Lots of times when we kind of grew up and asked most of the faith, it's not that it's any less vivid, but it's harder to discern it when,
yeah,
before.
Yeah, you don't have any
after.
Reference point.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Very true. Yeah. Thank you, Mary. Very fun to hear that. Anybody else got a reaction to this question? How has Jesus impacted your life?
I have a reaction.
Yeah.
I walked away from 38-year marriage because of the difference of the values between myself and my husband. And we went to church together, and he gave lip service to religion, but it wasn't in his life. It was, am I having fun yet? The he who dies with most toys wins. That's more his philosophy.
Sure.
And I'm very glad I did, because I've been able to do some wonderful things, some of which are for Holden, as a result of getting out from under his control. And I have felt so much the power come into my life since I did that.
Good for you.
Well, that takes a lot of courage.
That's a tough thing to
decide.
It takes courage, yeah. Mm. I agree. Good for you. How many years are we talking about you've been separated?
The divorce went through in June.
Oh, recent. Yeah. Good for you. Hang in there.
Yeah.
Hang in there. What's your name?
Oh, my name is Elaine Wagner.
Elaine?
Yeah.
Thank you,
Elaine. It's really interesting. It was a leap of faith. And it really was. Yeah, and it really was a good leap.
Good for you. Good for you.
And it was a good leap for him. Because he didn't need to be shackled to this idealist.
Yeah.
He needed to be with somebody who was more in with his line of thinking.
To use my friend.
And he goes to church
Mary.
Now.
Pardon me?
He still goes to church.
Well, he does.
Yeah.
Well, we could
He's gone him. Back. Mm-hmm. Only as Presbyterian church.
For heaven's sakes.
Well, but each his own.
And something in him.
Yeah.
Maybe the jolt was.
You probably never know. I call it a head trip when you try to guess what's going on.
Yeah.
You probably just don't know. But at least he has done it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, good for you, Elaine. Thanks for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it keeps on feeling positive and a good liberation for you. Good. I'm going to choose to take question one. That's kind of the heaviest one. Oh, golly, our time is flying. And let's look at that and try to quit with that question. One, if someone really wanted to understand what the cross and the crucifixion were all about, how would you explain it? Was it necessary, preordained, voluntary, a triumph over injustice? Was it a sacrifice for sin? Now I'm going to have you turn to your second sheet, and I'm going to give you a little pre-possible explanation, and we can discuss it as much as we want to. After I've read through it. What are you chuckling at?
I'm chuckling at all your corrections.
Pretty left brain, but let's just forget you even
chuckled. What's wrong with your computer?
Well, I was on a typewriter that I don't know how to use. That's why it's such a mess. I'm a good typist, but I didn't know how to get a backspace. I didn't know how to kind of, you know, I didn't know how to correct. So please just ignore the mess.
Well, I'm just laughing because your left brain a lot, and here all this mess.
It is a mess.
Yeah,
it is
a mess.
Perfection, total obedience to the law, seems to be the heaven's goal. For example, Matthew 5:48, be perfect, therefore as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now, I know that can be interpreted, mature, be whole, but perfect is the word we use in English. Two. The goal of perfection before the law was Jesus' goal as well. When Jesus went to the cross, his perfection score was 100%. In moving about living with Jesus, it is our understanding that the 12 disciples saw Jesus as sinless. Now, we have very little verses to prove that,
But it's our assumption that that's the way they saw Jesus. He was 100%. When any human being stands before the mandate of God's law and is confronted by the demand for performance of record of 100%, the expected outcome is predictable. For the sake of simplicity, man or a woman could be said to achieve a score of 0%. Paul appears to agree with James on this matter of one's record of achievement. Romans, as it is written, there is no one righteous, no 100%, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. We could term that 0%. James, for whoever keeps the whole law yet stumbles at just one point is guilty of breaking all of it. We could call that score 0%, you know, breaking it all. Four, it perhaps is stating a weighty matter in an oversimplified way, but one could put it this way. Jesus on the cross becomes the world of new math, the math of heaven. On the cross, Jesus takes our score of 0% and takes all of it into or onto himself. In place of it, he gives us sinners his score of 100%. That is heaven's righteousness. In Romans, it seems to be the case that this is precisely what Paul is saying. And of course, he says it so much better. Romans. You see, at just the right time when we were still powerless, that is 0%, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrated his own love for us in this, while we were yet sinners, that is 0%, Christ died for us. Since we now have been justified, that is declared 100% by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? Does that make any sense? Or do you think it holds water biblically, or do you think I'm making up kind of a, you know what? How do you call it? A pseudo story when it isn't?
Or analogy.
Now let's go back to the question I posed to number one. How do you understand the cross of Christ? You can use what we just read or put it in whatever way you'd like to. What do you think the cross means? And if you were asked to explain it to somebody, how would you explain it?
Are you talking about a literal? I mean, someone's asking exactly what happened to Christ and what that cross means for his death, or are we talking about it in more general terms about us carrying a cross?
No, not us carrying the cross. Mostly, what did the cross death of Jesus accomplish for humankind? Mm. It brought dismas to the other side into paradise. Mm-hmm. How about us? Mm-hmm. What does the cross accomplish? That's a tough one. It's hard to explain. Yeah?
Can we divert to a technicality? This is a very learned group, and I'm sure there are answers here. I was told there was a misconception that Jesus was nailed through the hands, that Jesus was actually nailed through the wrists.
I think that's
because
true.
The body wouldn't support
the hands, nail would rip out.
Yeah, so this is correct. When you talked about dismas, you said, they put the nails through my hands.
Yeah, I probably said it wrong. I meant through his wrist.
Okay.
But I said it wrong. Anyway.
Okay.
But you see, it's been translated like that for years because you always see in
the... Yeah, we see the hands in artist's paintings sometimes, but I think you're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have any further point to make, Elaine?
No, it's just technical thing.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Please bring him up, because like you said earlier, I can make it happen, yeah.
Yeah, well, the cross broke the power of death.
Very good.
Right. I mean, that's as simple as that. The power of death is no longer...
It's gone.
It's gone, right. Ensuring that the kingdom is going to come.
Living or dying, I now live.
Right.
Or winning or losing, I now win. Mm-hmm. And the cross has done that. It's taking me from a life of sin and a life of failure into a life of paradise.
Redemption,
yeah.
And it basically ties in with your question four, because, I mean, the real answer on four is totally, as was mentioned before. So,
Well, I know I'm rushing and oversimplifying, but I've got to get done by 10. I love comics. I don't always read it every day, but it's very... And I have a large file of comics that I used to use in sermons. This is B.C.
And it's the lady and the man. They don't have names. I'm going to start at frame three. The first one I don't think applies. There's a strike of lightning from the heavens. Zop! And it hits the man. And the woman is looking and says, oh my gosh. Second frame. The guy is lying on the mound, completely zonked out. And the lady says, hey, clumsy, are you okay? Frame three. The man sits up and says, I think I'll be just fine. The woman, are you sure? Frame four. The man says, oh, I've been struck before by lightning, you see. The woman, you have? Next frame. Oh, 20 or 30 times, I'd say, offhand. The man. The woman, good grief. Woman, whatever enables you to survive these things? The man, I don't know. Final frame. The man, looking up, says, I think somebody up there must like me.
Absolutely.
I love it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like business, you know, a little.
It's like us.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Would our interpretation of the significance of Jesus' death be any different if he were put to death in another fashion other than on the cross?
That's a good question. Help me out. I'm not sure.
I mean, as if you were stoned.
If you were stoned.
Yeah.
Or drowned. Or
hanged. Or,
yeah.
You know, decapitated. Or,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The fact that it's a slow, agonizing death is different than, say, a beheading, which is instantaneous.
Yeah.
You know.
But the cross was the method of execution of the time.
Right. What do you think, though? How would you answer it?
Well, I don't know. I think that I don't think it would have the impact that the cross has. For one thing, you wouldn't have a symbol.
That's right.
Symbol. I mean, I can't picture having a guillotine on the banner.
Although the noose does become a symbol.
That's for having this big rock that right over crushed him.
That's true. We laugh because it seems so ludicrous. Right?
Yeah.
Other than the cross, it doesn't make any sense.
That's because we've seen it since we were a child.
Yeah, for kids say 100 years, Dad.
Well, that would be an interesting exercise to think if Jesus came today and the same scenario happened and he was executed by the prevalent method of the day, then what would become the symbolism? What would become, how would all that evolve so that it became the saving grace that the cross has become for us? That'd be an interesting exercise.
Good thought.
Well, it'd be kind of bad today because he might not get executed.
He'd be in court for the rest of
the time. With the appeal after appeal.
Yeah.
He goes to the appeal process.
Parole board every 5 years.
Early. I like what one of my colleagues said. He didn't know when he died, and he didn't know how he died, but he knew where he died, and that'd be at a committee meeting.
That's a good one. Let's close with thinking of one thing from our study this morning we can take with us. Just one thing you remember, or one thing you'd like to hold on to. What might it be?
Last minute conversion.
Yeah.
Very good.
It's never too late.
Ah, that's mine.
Yeah.
There's always hope.
There's always hope.
It's never too late. Okay, you heard the bell. Let's close with prayer. Jesus, we don't always understand it as far as clearly stating it in simple language, what you did on the cross, but all of us know deep in our bones that without that cross, we don't know what might happen to us. And with it, we know there's hope. That death no longer has any hold or any can really express any fear for us. And we thank you, Jesus, that indeed you did die on a cross, and that this is one simple example of how it might be a moment of triumph for even us. Thank you, Lord, for this time we've had together this morning, and be with us now through the rest of this day. We ask it in your name. Amen. Thanks for coming. Good to see you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep.